to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? I hope you've all had a great week. Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, and this week I am very happy to tell you I have an interview with Tuur de Meester, probably one of my favourite people on Twitter, somebody I've been following for a while, somebody I've always wanted to sit down and have a chat with, and we managed to do it last week in San Francisco. But before I tell you about the interview, I've got a message from my show sponsors. Please do listen to this, please do check them out as they enable me to keep this show going. So, firstly, crypto investors in the US, I want to introduce you to Equity Trust. They can educate you on the possibilities of protecting your profits, as it is possible to mitigate taxes by investing in cryptocurrency with your IRA. With a self-directed IRA, you can invest in Bitcoin and other crypto in a potentially tax-deferred or tax-free way. If this sounds interesting to you, then you can discover more by visiting trustetc.com/crypto. They have a free guide which will explain the potential benefits and possibilities for you to invest in a tax-advantaged environment. Get your guide now at trustetc.com/crypto. Next up, I also want to tell you about Casa. You might be aware of them from my interview with Jameson Lopp. He moved to them recently, and I've been following them since the interview. When Bitcoin has enabled individuals to be their own bank for nearly a decade, there are many people who are either choosing to use trusted third parties out of convenience or finding out the hard way that they did not sufficiently prepare to be a bank. Casa enables you to secure your private keys without having to convert your home into a physical fortress. The multi-signature, multi-device, multi-location architecture keeps you safe against theft, disaster, and even negligence. That means Casa also helps with inheritance procedure, passing your crypto wealth to your heirs with keys in their control. Let Casa guide you through the high learning curve of key management in order to avoid unforeseen pitfalls. Find out more and apply for Casa at keys.casa. That is KEYS.CASA. Okay, so on to the interview. Firstly, I want to say Tuur is without doubt the nicest person I have ever interviewed. I was going up to San Francisco to do the interview from LA, and when I got to my hotel, I realized I'd left all my recording equipment back in LA. It was quite late, and I dropped in a message just to apologize, asking to reschedule. And rather than reschedule, he came back to me with suggestions and actually started looking at places for us to hire equipment, which was obviously very nice of him. But luckily, we managed to find a studio that we could use at Blockchain Capital. So I have to say thank you to Spencer for allowing us to use that. Tuur was just such a nice guy. If you ever get a chance to meet him, I think you'll see what I mean. I've wanted to talk to him for a long time. I've been aware he has a long history in Bitcoin. And in preparing for the interview, I went out and read everything he had written. He's written a bunch of posts on Medium. Not loads, but over time he's written like many, many useful posts. So I went through them all. But interestingly, there was this article in the middle where he talks about separating himself from his family. And as I knew I was going to encourage everyone to go and read all his Medium posts, I did ask him if we could talk about this because, you know, I knew other people would be aware of this article, and he was happy to. So when this interview starts, you're going to see that we're going to be talking about this. And I recommend going to check out the article. I'll share it in the show notes. But we do also talk about Bitcoin. We do get into other things about the state of the economy and why Bitcoin is so important and some of the predictions he originally made for Ethereum. So, I hope you enjoy this interview. Also, please do support the show. If you can, leave me a review on iTunes, a 5-star review if you think I deserve it. They all help. I do see it when you guys message me to say you've done it, and I appreciate it every single time. Please also follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Steam, Medium, everywhere. My handle is always at WhatBitcoinDid. Feel free also to reach out to me. Please check out my website. I mentioned it needs a bit of work. I'm going to be doing an overhaul soon. I think a number of my opinions have changed on things, so I need to update that. But check out my website on www.whatbitcoindid.com. Also, feel free to email me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And please do share this out with your friends and family. Please do stick it up on Twitter and let everyone else know about this interview. I see it every time you do it, and I'm always very grateful. Okay, so on to the interview. I hope you enjoy it. If you do have any questions, do feel free to reach out to me. As I said, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I pretty much reply to anyone, so do feel free to reach out to me. Okay, I hope you enjoy the interview. Morning, Arthur. How are you?
Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Thank you for agreeing to come on the podcast. We've avoided a disaster with recording equipment, so we owe a big thank you to Spencer this morning. So, how are you?
Doing great, thanks.
I've known about you for quite a while. You've obviously somebody who stands out within Bitcoin, and I say loosely crypto, but within Bitcoin.
And when I last interviewed Jameson Lopp, he suggested I come and meet you and talk to you about economics of Bitcoin. But I've also been doing my own research. And as I said to you before we started, I went through your Medium post and I actually found this very interesting post where you talked about separating yourself from your family. And I know it's a strange start because we're here to talk about Bitcoin, but that article seemed to resonate with a lot of people. So if you don't mind, I'd like to explore that. Where did that come from? What happened?
Yeah, I guess it's a hard thing to like summarize. I would say it was the end. I guess it was a step in a long process that is still ongoing, where I was thinking about, you know, my personal life and my relationships and also my personal health, like emotional health, physical health. And so it was something really, you know, before I made that decision to separate myself from, you know, you could say from my family of origin or from my family, where I grew up was, it was, I would say 10 years went by where I was, you know, trying to mend things or trying to, kind of come to, a relationship that would have some balance and where I would feel good. And it kept not working out. And so eventually I considered, you know, making that big step of like, you know, living my life independently and really deliberately choosing who would be a part of my life and who wouldn't. And so it involved a lot of therapy. It involved a lot of, thinking, a lot of like, it was definitely the hardest decision that I've ever made. It was really, really tough. But in hindsight, I still feel that it was a good decision, and I don't consider it to be something that I can never, I can never reverse. Like, I can always decide next month or next year that I do want to reach out to them or that I want to try something. But as far as my personal health, it's been the best decision. I really feel, and so I have gotten a lot of emails and response from people who are in a tough situation with their family and who have a similar struggle. And who just have this same experience of like, well, you know, I didn't choose to grow up in this environment and now I'm here and I'm kind of like growing into being an adult, or I have been, and it's a constant struggle. And so I'm really wanting to know what all the options are. And so it's I would say it's still a taboo thing to consider or to do. So it's been really rewarding to read those emails, and I usually respond. And I don't, I guess I want to clarify, like, I don't have a kind of a prescriptive view on this. Like, I think it's extremely personal. It's extremely subjective. What's right for one person isn't for the other. And so, that's also why, like, I'm not really, I don't really write about this often. It was just helpful at the time, and I'm glad I put it out there.
Have you maintained the relationship with your sister and her children? Because that felt like that was the tough bit.
Yeah, that's still hard because I grew attached to her children, and then, it was like, where do I draw the line? And then eventually I did talk to other people who made similar decisions to kind of like ask them, like, how do things go over the years? And, at least it's been what, like 4 years now, 3-4 years. For my own, as difficult as it was, I made it clear that I was always open if they wanted to reach out to me. And I'm talking about my I guess, what is the word again? Cousins? Because I always mix it up.
Nieces and nephews?
Nieces and nephews, yeah. And so I'm still open for that. But like, as far as me actively reaching out, I haven't done that. And I would say that's been the hardest part, where it's like, but I felt that it was important to make it very clear and complete, at least in the beginning. And then later I can kind of go back and reconsider. And are there particular members of my family that I do want to reach out to? I might decide that later on. But so far I feel like I'm still kind of, you know, I feel nervous talking about this. Like, okay. It's really like, and I think the nervosity or the sensation is kind of like, even talking about considering reaching out is anxiety provoking. Like, there's definitely stuff there that is related to trauma that I've been through. And so, yeah, it just, you know, it's constantly something that, and it's also because of it being a taboo thing, and it is scary for other people to even consider that. You often meet kind of skepsis or people who, like, anytime there's something online about this, like, there's people who will be like, oh, well, but why don't you live and let live, and, you know, you might regret this, and, you know, who kind of like subtly try to communicate that I might have made the wrong decision. So yeah, like, it's a valid question to ask, like, but the way it's worked for me is that my perspective is hygiene, like, really, like, try to, you know, I think it's fair to say that I grew up around a lot of psychological dysfunction, and so it's hard to then, you know, not become dysfunctional yourself if you keep being exposed to that psychological dysfunction. And so, like, from that perspective, the hygienic decision has been the right one for me.
Okay, and the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I'm going to recommend everyone goes to Medium and reads pretty much all your posts, because there's not a lot over the years, but they're all very important. And then in the middle, there is this article, though, and I was quite interested to understand why you'd put it out there. Was it for, you know, personal cleansing, or was it because you hoped it would help others?
It was mostly personal. It was really like, you know, it's like this double-edged sword of putting things out there in the open. But I think... I think it's basically helped me find peace with it. It's like, it was just, you know, doing the exercise of writing it in itself was therapeutic, but then, like, putting it out there, it kind of makes it real. And at the same time, it's potential conversation starter. And that's what I still think, looking back on it. It's like, it's out there. People can see it and read it, make up their own mind. And so, you know, having those people reach out to me over the years, it's just been really helpful in terms of, like, yeah, like, it is an okay thing to do. Like, you know, I am an adult. I make my own decisions. And this is the kind of decision that's extremely, you know, difficult. But for some people, it's the right thing to do. Like, so it's kind of like doing the opposite of what was difficult over the years, is that this taboo thing of, like, you know, to break the taboo, basically. Like, for me, that was the most important. And yeah, I mean, I do, you know, looking back, and I might do some more writing over time, it is, I'm glad that it's helpful to people. And so it's definitely a great additional thing that I hadn't really expect would happen. Because it's, you know, one of my articles that gets the most reads. Mm. Definitely evergreen in that sense.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, I do also want to talk to you about Bitcoin. I will share that out, though, so you might get some more people read it and contact you. So... just for those people who don't know you, Arthur, could you just give a little bit about your background in terms of college? Because I read that you've got no degree, but you did various classes. So your educational background, career background, and how you've got to where you are now with in crypto and Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I was always interested in philosophy and history, like quite like academic type subjects. One of the things that I knew when graduating from high school is, like, I really didn't know what I wanted. Like, I knew I didn't know. So I did, like, worked for a year as a volunteer in Norway. I started to study African language and culture. Then I switched to economics and political science. And then being at university, I met some people who were starting a little private school, a K-12 school. So I jumped on board with that, and I helped them do that. Later, I lived in Holland to do the same thing, starting another private school that was K-12. And then the academic interest, like, I had some friends, and we were all kind of frustrated with what we thought we were lacking at university. And so we founded our own academic institute, which was the Rothbard Institute. So we would translate books and put together seminars, summer university, those kind of things. So that was, to me, like, I would consider that more than the actual university to be my academic training. And I had some aspirations thinking like, oh, maybe I want to become a professor and I'll just, you know, now that I'm like nearing being 20 years old, I'll like, maybe I'll do that. But then just looking at how long that roadmap was, and then also meeting professors and seeing them kind of be stuck in tenure and kind of, you know, being in an environment that was not friendly to them. Again, like maybe this hygiene thought of like, well, it's kind of miserable to be in that institution and you kind of maybe you can't speak your own mind and those kind of things. So and then at the same time, my knowledge about the financial system grew. And I just grew more worried about, you know, what is going to happen if we get a financial crisis that's severe. And this was before 2008. It was really like, just reading about the history of banking crises and how inflation happens. And then it seemed to me that, yeah, like this is kind of like a forest that, that's very, very dry and it could, you know, there could be a forest fire and economically speaking in the West and in Europe. So that's how I started writing more about current day economic affairs. And then in 2011, I struck a deal with a publisher and I started my own financial newsletter. And then part of the idea of like trying to, you know, it tied in with my own personal experience of, you know, feeling very vulnerable financially, because I never had an education about how to manage money or how to be responsible career-wise. I really felt like I had to do it myself, and it was kind of my lifeline. Like if I could become financially independent, then I could make my own decisions better. I could decide where to put my kids in school, because I was involved in these private schools, and then realizing like, oh my God, if I keep doing what I'm doing right now, I won't even be able to afford sending my kids to a school like this. So like, so I really had to kind of, you know, reinvent myself. So part of that was making trips to Latin America and learning about economies that are, you know, less burdened with debt, but that have their bouts of crises over the years, and then trying to find out like, what do individuals do to protect themselves against that? It really was my intention making those trips. And then of course it was also maybe I would move to Latin America, because I knew I wanted to work online, and so in a way I had that freedom. And that's how in 2011 I learned about Bitcoin in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And then it took me a little while to really kind of be like, yes, this is valid technology that could help protect people who want to be independent. I was already researching gold quite a bit as well. And so I started writing about it, and then early 2012 recommended it as an investment to my readers. Like we had a subscription-based newsletter. And then from 2013 onwards, I just went full-time into Bitcoin.
Wow. Okay. So quite a journey. And you mentioned 2008. And since then, we've had this is the largest bull run in history, right?
The stock market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny enough, it was on the news last night. And then.
We have new all-time highs, right?
New all-time highs, longest bull run in history. And they've put it down to a number of factors, but one of the ones is monetary policy.
Yeah.
Yet behind this, we have increase in debt and a increase in debt burden, especially in the US.
Right.
So do you feel like there is a potential that this is all going to come crashing down at some point? And this is one of the reasons why people are so interested in Bitcoin, is that it won't have, it's as people say, like safety says, it's sound money. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, like in the, I need to read up on it again, kind of refresh my memory. But in the Roman times, there was this tradition of every time there was a new emperor, you would have a debt jubilee. It was kind of, you know, the debts would be eradicated and people could start from scratch, because historically, this is how a lot of slavery came into being, is that the farmers would have a bad crop. They'd have to borrow to buy new seeds and to maybe even rent land. And then if they had a few bad years, they would basically become chronically indebted. And then that debt would be transferred to their children. And so you would be born in debt and be a slave, right? You'd have your master that you would have to constantly pay debts to. And over time, you would even forget that, you know, there's a particular amount of debt to be owed, and that you could, you know, it would not even be conceivable to pay it off. And so they're welcome to have this tradition of debt jubilees. And of course, that's disappeared, and I don't think that should necessarily be reinstated. But it's just something that happens in the economy when there's too much debt. At some point, it just gets eradicated. Either it is that the party who owes the money defaults, which is basically saying, like, look, I can't pay this anymore. I'm just going to go bankrupt, and you can't make that claim anymore. I'm going to walk away from this. Or the money that the debt is owed in, the money defaults, so to speak. The money has very high inflation, and then it becomes very easy to just pay off the debt. It's like worth pennies in the end. So that's been my observation, is that eventually debt gets wiped out. But the problem that we have in you know, our economy today is that debt has been securitized, wrapped in, you know, it's been made into financial instruments, and they're bonds, right? Government bonds, private market bonds. And then those bonds have been bought by pension funds, by endowments, by banks. And so to them, they are assets, right? And people count on those bonds to pay their retirements, right? Years and years from now, they count on that. And so if the money that the bonds are expressed in, if that becomes valueless, then all that value gets wiped out. So it's a bond crash. And so that can happen by defaults, or it can happen if the money inflates or hyperinflates. So that is the kind of looming crisis. Like, the debts are too high to ever be paid off. The interest rates are artificially low, which causes the debt to blow up more, to become larger. And at the same time, it's kind of a fuse to this bomb, because if at any point interest rates are pushed up, then it becomes impossible to pay them off, right? I mean, imagine if you have $1 million debt, and you have like a 1% interest on them. It means like, what, like 10,000, if you pay $10,000 a year, then you don't incur more debt, right? You're flat. But of course, if that interest rate jumps to 4, 5, 6%, all of a sudden it's 50, 60, 70 grand that you owe. And if your income doesn't allow for that, then the debt is just going to explode in your face. So rising interest rates is very dangerous. And right now, central banks know that. They know that governments would just have to default if the interest rate were to go up. And so they choose to just keep printing money, keep the interest rates low. Like, I think it's like $12 trillion in debt is already at negative interest rates, which is kind of weird that, you know, you actually have to pay money to be indebted. And so I think eventually this process of zero interest rate policy and printing money up the wazoo is going to lead to very high inflation. So that's kind of my, you know, how I see things happen in the next 10, 15 years. And it's hard to predict when exactly that'll happen, because these things tend to take forever until they all of a sudden happen in a day. But I struggle to see how it's anything else but inevitable.
So an inevitable financial crisis on what scale? Bigger than 2008?
It's just a different type. I think that it'll be more impactful than 2008, because usually what happens when there is you know, very severe stagflation, when there is a bond market problem, is that banks really get in trouble, and then you get, you know, you have to more think about what happened in Argentina in the year 2001 with the Corralito, basically that the government declares a bank holiday, and you can know it sounds kind of nice, but it means that you can no longer access the money in your bank account. They freeze the assets because, you know, usually there's a run on the bank, because the way it happened in Argentina was that the local debt, local government debt, was bought up by the banks, and that was backing the bank accounts. And so, but the local government started defaulting on the debt. And so people made the connection. It's like, hey, well, you know, these banks all of a sudden are becoming insolvent because those bonds are crashing. Let's just run and try to withdraw our money. And then, you know, obviously the bank didn't have enough money to pay everyone, which is what happened in the movie The Beautiful Life. It's like one of the few movies where you see an actual bank run. And so the government just goes like, all right, we'll just close the bank. And then they devalue the currency to relieve the debtors from how much they owe. It's kind of like a partial default. And then they open up again, but all of a sudden your money is worth way, way less than it was before the bank holiday. So yeah, this is very severe. Like, money is like the blood of the economy, and once that goes wrong, it's tough. Like, you know, you look at Turkey today, right? Have very high inflation. Venezuela, like, this is really It hits very hard. It's like extremely tough medicine, and it usually takes, in the West, when it happens, hyperinflation, it lasts about 1 or 2 years, and then things kind of start slowly normalizing again.
Wow. And do you therefore see, are you seeing alignment between an impending financial crisis and the opportunity for people to protect themselves with Bitcoin?
Yeah, like, I think this is, you know, I don't want to proclaim that it's absolutely inevitable that we'll have Venezuela-style hyperinflation. I think that there is a possibility where we'll have, like, stagflation, kind of like in the 70s, where inflation is, like, double digits, but it doesn't go to, like, absolutely, you know, insane levels. But even so, like, people's savings will be eroded in a situation like that, especially the middle class, the working class, people that have more cash than, you know, the wealthy people. They can have stocks and things that kind of preserve value over time, and gold and those kind of things. But so, yes, I do think that, especially for, you know, like millennials, they kind of grew up, you know, once they, in their early adulthood, they saw the financial crisis happen. And then there was this whole notion, which their parents had always told them, like, oh yeah, and, you know, invest in real estate, invest in stocks, and it's, you know, and then that story kind of had a big crack in it. So I think that many millennials, they've never owned a blue stock chip or a blue chip stock or traditional investments. And so they've been kind of, and they've never had a lot of capital either. And so, and they do at the same time see that the baby boom generation is very huge and is going to be an increasing burden on them, right? The millennials are paying in many respects directly for the pensions of the baby boomers. So it's kind of like, huh, wait a minute, like, you know, what about my pension, right? You know, how do I know that my pension is going to be there? And if it is there, how do I know how much these dollars or euros or whatever are going to be worth? So, like, I think that, yes, the millennials have an appetite for Bitcoin from this point of view. It's kind of like, huh, like, I understand the internet. I understand that there is such a thing as an intangible digital asset. I was torrenting movies in my teenage years. Like, I understand peer-to-peer. And so I think that there is something there where it's like, you know, this could be something that can hedge potential bad outcomes for me.
So, like, an insurance on fiat.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we were talking about, I think Pierre Rochard on Twitter was talking about, you know, that people who caution about Bitcoin being a bubble at the same time have no problem recommending that 18-year-olds go into debt for $100 or $200,000 to get an education in a very insecure job environment. So then, yeah, I brought the suggestion of, like, well, maybe you can buy one Bitcoin and that can hedge your student debt. All right, maybe 10 years from now, you can pay off the entire debt with that one Bitcoin. You know, I'm not saying it's guaranteed, but, you know, it's something to consider.
Well, I think that there are certainly hints from Venezuela and Turkey that people do consider Bitcoin a hedge, or they do see, yeah, consider it a store of value.
I think ING actually did a survey 2 months ago, and in Europe, they only had like 15,000 respondents, I think about 1,000 in every country. But at least from that, it looked like Turkey had the highest Bitcoin adoption in Europe. It was right, like 13-14%.
And we're aware people obviously have been using it in Venezuela, and I think people keep getting lost in this store of value, expecting that a store of value means it's going to hold value in every single country in the world and
right,
appreciate
it. Or it's going to be perfectly stable.
Yeah, which is not realistic. But the store of value seems to be when economies are in trouble, and therefore, people could come late on like they have with Turkey, or people could hedge right now, which, yeah, seems like, you know, say millennials are. So long term, you're obviously bullish about the opportunity with Bitcoin.
Yeah, just to jump in on the store of value comment, it's like, people don't realize, but, like, for example, being in Argentina when the country is locked down, like, literally the government knows their currency is being, the value of their currency is being doubted by the entire population, and everybody kind of is wanting to get out of the peso. So what they do is they try and ring fence the entire country, prevent money from flowing in and out. So if you're in that situation, what can you do? You can buy some real estate that's crashing. You can buy some stocks, which, interestingly, that happened in 2012, is that the Argentine stock market actually had a massive bull run because people were using that mechanism to move money out of the country. They bought stocks in Argentina and they sold the same stocks for dollars in the US. And so having Bitcoin, even if Bitcoin goes down 20 or 30% temporarily, it's still something that you can spend abroad. You can travel abroad, you can spend it. And you couldn't do that with, you cannot do it with cash dollars, which, you know, they might get taken from you at the border. You cannot take gold on your person. And then if you try and send pesos abroad, the government is going to give you a 40% penalty. Like, so those are things to keep in mind from our Western point of view. Is like, same in India, same in so many other countries that have capital controls. Like, it's not just the monetary value or volatility that's a factor. It's also like, is this something liquid that I can carry with me, that I can spend when I'm abroad? Can I send it to my kids who live abroad? Can my kids send the money to me? Like, those are all factors that have to be taken into account, I think.
So obviously, long term, a more stable Bitcoin price would be better.
Yeah.
But I guess it's difficult for Bitcoin to be stable in every country when there's different interest rates, different appreciation, devaluations of currencies. Therefore, at the moment, the primary use case, therefore, I see the two is for people to protect value in struggling economies, but also future insurance in even in Western economies then, which is pretty interesting, which is therefore a very bullish long-term view. But also at the same time, you are still short-term bearish.
Yeah, like, you know, Bitcoin has these cycles. Like, it's a startup currency. Like, you know, it doesn't have the properties that, you know, we think it can have a few years from now, and it probably will have. And at the same time, the attention to Bitcoin, it comes in waves. It's driven by the price is a signal that people pick up on. And so when a lot of people buy Bitcoin, it gets in the news, and then more people come in and more people buy it. Even if they don't understand it, they will have some exposure. And then when the price goes down, all of a sudden, it feels like a very different asset. I bought this asset that I thought was going to only go up, and now all of a sudden it's going down aggressively, and I panic and I sell. And so, you know, Bitcoin adoption happens in these waves, and we've seen three big ones so far. And I think it'll keep happening that way, even though the actual volatility is going to slow down. But really, it's you know, it's different than, for example, the radio as a technology. When that was adopted, if more people wanted it, the manufacturers could just make more of them. But you can't do that with Bitcoin. You cannot make more Bitcoins. Of course, we've seen this proliferation of altcoins. Like, people can create kind of knockoffs, but they don't have the same properties. They have a lot more risks involved with them. And so it's just the way it goes. Adoption happens in cycles. And so, yeah, we've just come down of this gigantic rise in price. Like, people don't realize often, but the bottom of the bull phase, the very start of the bull phase was over 30 months before the peak, right? The peak was $20,000 in December, January, about 8 months ago. You have to go back 30, 35 months to find the very beginning of that rally. And that was when Bitcoin was $150. So we went from $150 all the way to $20,000. And so I think it's only reasonable that the market just needs some time to, like, digest that and, like, man, what just happened here? And let the dust settle, and then regulators are going to have some things to say, and people need to pay some taxes. And people have also bought, you know, they kind of thrown Bitcoin together, lumped it together with all these other coins. They bought a basket. And so now they feel horrified that some of these coins are down 85, 95%. And so I think often they throw Bitcoin away with the bathwater. It's kind of like, you know, they're kind of just a little disgusted, and they need a break. So that's why, yeah, I'm not super bullish for the rest of the year. I think we could see lower prices. Price could go sideways for a while. But then, you know, there's going to be a huge catalyst going forward. We're going to likely see a Bitcoin ETF. Bitcoin supply is going to be cut in half by 2020. I don't know if you've talked about that to your listeners.
A little bit, yeah. I'm wondering if that will just be gradually priced in rather than a dramatic single event. I wasn't involved during the previous halving.
Yeah, it was actually a catalyst. It was a pretty strong catalyst because people realized, like, huh, the previous annual increase in supply was 12% before the previous halving, and the 12% got cut down to 6%. And then right now what's going to happen is we're going to go from 5, I think, to about 2.5%. And so I think the market understands that, you know, miners are overall, as a whole, pretty agnostic to Bitcoin. They just mine the coins and they sell them into the market. I'm not saying when there's a very strong rally, usually they hoard more coins, but then they will sell more on the way down. So, you know, the net is that they're actually pretty flat Bitcoin. So all that supply just gets dumped onto the market. And so I do think it's, you know, the market feels that. Well, all this, like, imagine if it's hard to say, you know, there are, if oil production would get cut in half, like oil prices would obviously go up. Like, you know, so it's kind of similar to something like that. And the market knows this. But I mean, the market just needs stories. You know, it's just a story that will likely drive the price up, right? It doesn't mean that it's not a mechanical thing. Like, there's always psychology in markets. And so I just, you know, I look at that and it's real, but it's also, I think, going to be a story, the story of the ETF as well. But at the same time, it's real because Bitcoin will become accessible to so many more people in such an easy way, and the funds and et cetera, et cetera.
Next up, I talked to Tuur about what he thinks are the most important things coming up for Bitcoin. But before that, a message from another one of my show sponsors. So this is really for my US listeners, as I want to talk to you about Stamps.com, who approached us to advertise on the podcast, which is really, really cool. So you know what, guys? These days, you can pretty much get anything on demand. Even my podcast, you might be listening to this the day it's released, or you might be listening to it a week later, a month later, who knows? But you have the convenience of listening to it whenever it suits you. And did you know you can also get your postage on demand with Stamps.com? I didn't. I don't have this in the UK. So this is pretty cool, right? With Stamps.com, you can access all their services off the post office right from your desk. That's it, right? You can buy and print real US postage for any letter or any package right from your home. It's all available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just go to their website, click print, mail, and you're done. That's Stamps.com. You can even weigh your letters and packages and print the exact postage at the exact time you need it. So I'm not sure about you guys, but I still go to the post office. I still queue up and have my packages weighed and ready to post. With Stamps.com, you don't need to do this. So if you're wasting your time with this, then I recommend you go and check out the website and save yourself a whole bunch of time. And right now, they have a special offer for you. They have a 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and up in the top right-hand corner, you'll see a radio microphone. Click on that and type in Bitcoin to get your special offer. That's Stamps.com with a special offer of Bitcoin.
What do you think are some of the most important things for Bitcoin adoption over the next few years? We've obviously got, you've talked about ETFs coming.
Yeah.
I expect we'll get another dinner of today. But at some point between now and next year, one will be approved. And interesting, I'd also love to know your view on Caitlin Long's comments. I don't know if you've seen them.
Right.
But obviously, financial products will open the market to more institutional investors or wider institutional investors. Also, the technology, you know, better wallets with Lightning Network will have increased faster payment opportunities. And then also education, just educating people about Bitcoin. What do you find out of those kind of three areas? What are most important, or is it all just important for you?
Well, I think that they all interplay. I think Trace Mayer is, you know, he identified correctly these like seven drivers to the Bitcoin price over time, Bitcoin adoption, and they're all factors that are tailwinds, and they complement each other. So one of the things that I think is underestimated so far is the amount of financialization that will happen around Bitcoin, where Bitcoin is, you know, there's going to be Bitcoin futures, Bitcoin options, Bitcoin ETFs, you know, and so Bitcoin will become a part of what institutions invest in, like insurance companies, endowments, eventually pension funds. And I think that'll be more than is visible now. That'll be the strongest part of Bitcoin adoption in the next 10 years. I think that baby boomers will not so much have Bitcoin on their phone. I think they will be exposed to it even without them knowing it. It'll be their insurance company all of a sudden owns Bitcoin. It'll be their pension funds that has it, those kind of things. So when we're talking about how do we go from 2 or 5% adoption today to 70 or 80%, I think that'll be the main driver. And of course, at the same time, the fact that Bitcoin is decentralized, the fact that Lightning network is going to grow and grow, and that we'll have this trustless way of interacting with Bitcoin, is going to validate the main proposition, the main idea that this is censorship resistant. Like it'll like that'll be the cutting edge where we'll see all these applications that over and over will prove that it's you can't really mess with Bitcoin. You can try and hijack it. You can try and make a better Bitcoin or something like that. But you'll probably fail. And so I think there'll be this, in a way, it'll seem like two different worlds, but they will strengthen each other. It's like the fact that ETFs exist, the fact that insurance companies own it, they will legitimize the more, radical use cases, just like with the internet, where it's like the fact that banks plugged in and became online, the fact that governments started coming online, it legitimized the kind of things that people were scared of. It was like, oh my God, online gambling, or all these like weird opinions, or you can be anonymous on the internet. It's kind of like, they both complemented each other. And I think the similar thing is going to happen with Bitcoin adoption. And I'm excited about both.
Absolutely. Wow. And as I mentioned before, I noticed you shared a section from a Tamás Blummer article. I'll just quote it. I argue in this writing that central bank-controlled digital currencies will soon challenge Bitcoin. The main motivation there is to allow for sustained and significant negative interest rates. So I've got two questions there. But the first question really relates to central bank-controlled digital currencies being a threat to Bitcoin. So we obviously have our first. In Venezuela, we have the Petro. It's obviously a shit coin. It's obviously something we can't be trusted. But it's happened. And obviously, we've seen stories about other countries and other governments considering central bank issued cryptocurrencies, which will never be able to be trusted as much as Bitcoin, but they are still a potential threat. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I have a tweet that's out there, and I've kind of made it into a thread over time. And it says the period of 2018 to 2020 is going to be the hold my beer phase for governments and Fortune 500 companies. And the idea is that they're all going to launch their own currencies. Like before, it was like ICOs were scrappy and they were like, kind of scammy and startup-y. But at the same time, there was this massive amount of money that went around in it. So I think that this is being observed and watched. And I think that, in some way, it's very interesting how it's kind of a... All of a sudden, central banks are no longer the king of the world, right? They have to start having some humility that competition exists, and that when consumers make their decisions about which currency to use or to save in, now they have more choice than they had before. And so, to think about central banks issuing digital currency, it's probably not going to be a cryptocurrency, right? Because it won't be decentralized, but they'll try to build in some features that people like, maybe like auditability, maybe like inflation control, or whatever they think that people might want, which I think is great. And I don't know if you'll agree or the audience will agree, but recently I watched this interview, which came out, which was with John Cleese and I forget who I think it was Palin. Michael Palin, and it was right when The Life of Brian came out, which was this movie that is kind of a Jesus story. How do you call it? Kind of a caricature of the Jesus story. And so they asked them about it, and I think it was in 1979. And they actually had two members, very prominent members of the Anglican Church, also come in. I think it was a bishop and another person. And the way these two individuals were talking about that movie, and that it was so horrific, and that they were poisoning the minds of these young impressionable kids with that movie, and also even the tone that they had, they just it was really kind of an arrogance that oozed from that. And I think it was that they came from a position where they just always had that monopoly. They had the monopoly on the kind of the public and this authority, position of authority. And so I think that we see some of the things that we hear from central bankers now kind of come from that same place, where they just assume that this is all just kind of you know, something in the margin and it'll never get anywhere. And so I can just talk down on it. And I think that tone is going to gradually change, just like how the tone of the church, however you define that, has kind of mildened and become a bit more humble over the years. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
No, it does. And, you know, we have seen a changing narrative. We have seen, and not just from central banks, we've seen it from JP Morgan. We've seen it from Goldman Sachs. We've seen a recognition that this isn't going away and it is part of our economy and people do want to own it. Where I struggle with central bank cryptocurrencies is that I already really have a digital currency with my pound. I can spend it on my card. I can move it from bank account to bank account.
Yeah.
So unless they create a Bitcoin-type clone, a government altcoin, I struggle to understand what is the point of them creating a cryptocurrency.
Right. Yeah, so there can be like different schools of thought. Like, if you read papers written by the Bank for International Settlements, the IMF, and this goes back, I found papers that went back all the way to 1996 about, you know, because theoretically people knew that this is possible to create a digital currency that's private market based. And so what you see there is concern about seigneurage. Like basically, if you have the monopoly of a currency, then you can generate revenues for yourself, and that's your income. So which is, you know, some of the money that central banks create, they keep for themselves or they benefit the government because central bank will buy the government debt, right? And then finances the government in that way. So they were afraid that, look, if this really catches on, we could lose that income. So that's kind of the place where they're coming from. And you see this when, you know, originally in the 19th century, you know, we were on a gold standard. So governments were disciplined because they could not, they cannot just create new gold, but eventually the paper that the gold was backed by was kind of like detached, and they actively worked to detach that. And so what you saw happen in the 40s, 50s, and 60s is that even though the U.S. Officially was on a gold standard, only very large banks and governments were able to redeem paper dollars for gold. And so General de Gaulle did that. The French the leader of France, he actually kept redeeming physical gold and put it in the French vaults for the dollars that they had. And this was a problem because the U.S. gold was being depleted. And so that's why in the early 70s, Nixon closed the gold window and cut the tie between. So from then on, nobody could redeem dollars for gold anymore. So gold kind of was this thorn in the heel of governments because it was kind of it performed better than the dollar. And so there is literature on this where the founders of the euro, they were thinking about this since the 60s. One author is Alexandre Lamfalussy, who is considered to be the godfather of the euro. He has this paper in the 60s where he's talking about the demonetization of gold and how do we do that. And so my interpretation of that effort is that they created the euro to kind of create this spectacle where the dollar was going to compete with the euro and then people would kind of forget about gold, right? Rather than have the gold compete with the dollar, and that is kind of an obvious win for gold because it's obviously scarce, we'll create this like, so it's kind of a, in some way, it's like a you create this straw man that people can then root for or root against. And they've done that, right? And then at the same time, there was the London gold pool where central banks would come together and actively try and control the gold price by strategically selling gold reserves into the market and depressing the price. And then, of course, by the year 2000, 2004, they were kind of exhausted. And that's why the gold price has recovered. So it's a kind of a long story that I'm telling you. But so I think that for central banks to support or create a digital currency that is a little bit more Bitcoin-like, it would maybe create the same story where it's like the dollar versus their own currency. And then people would be distracted by that and kind of, you know, not want to go into Bitcoin so much anymore. So maybe it would be a Bitcoin airdrop or something like that. And so I think that's possible. And I think the other route that is, I think, likely eventually to happen, maybe even more likely, is a kind of a central bank for Bitcoin where, Bitcoin exchanges, they occasionally will get in trouble. Either they will have fractional reserve, which we saw happen in the wildcat banking era in the 19th century, where banks would emit more gold certificates than they had gold in their vault, and then there was a bank run. And then, you know, the emperor had no clothes, they didn't have enough, they would have to go bankrupt. So you had these occasional crises. And so that's how actually the Federal Reserve Act was conceived. There was a series of bank runs in 1907. Banks went bankrupt, and the government was like, hey, we can no longer allow this. So let's just pool all the gold in a central repository, in several, and that's going to be the network of Federal Reserve banks. And then those are going to be the insurers of the private bank. So whenever a private bank gets in trouble, they'll get a bailout from the central system. And so I think that something like that is very conceivable, where, you know, the government will mandate, and I'm not saying I'm advocating for this at all, right? I think that would actually add significant vulnerability to, you know, the crises would happen less frequently, would be a lot, you know, more severe, right? If the central bank of Bitcoin gets hacked, imagine, right? All people's real Bitcoin that gets stolen, that would really be a huge problem. So, but I do think that kind of thinking is something that we'll see. The next 10 years, there'll be a lot of word about that, because right now that's what institutions worry about, is like, I want to get involved in Bitcoin, but are my deposits insured? And how do you insure an asset that increases in value on average by like 40-50% a year, right? Who wants to do that? So self-insurance, which is what happens in the security sector, which is the DTCC system, basically. A share in Facebook or Google or any kind of company, it has to be scarce. You can't just replicate that. So you need a system to keep those certificates secure. And people do that with clearinghouses. And it's kind of a network that where the big players insure each other, right, rather than that they outsource that work to one insurance company, because then you have this additional vulnerability. So I think that'll be the struggle, is like, are we going to have this Federal Reserve Central Bank of Bitcoin? Or is it going to be more a voluntary-based system where the big players kind of have each other's back, and there's no subsidies involved, or there's not a huge amount of government involved? Or maybe a third one that I'm not thinking of, because there's a lot more possible in Bitcoin with multi-sig and time locks. So there could be this market-based solution that doesn't really look like DTCC today, that could be like, you know, kind of a joker card. But anyway, like that's where... Or, I don't know, this is my thoughts on where the regulators' minds are at.
Or Bitcoin could just end bank bailouts.
Well, I think that yes and no. Because yes, to some extent, because Bitcoin is highly auditable. Like with Bitcoin, you can basically put pressure on an exchange or a Bitcoin bank and say, "Hey, like, come on, don't kid me, okay? The Bitcoin blockchain is the most transparent database on the planet. Surely you can point us to where these assets are, or you can somehow prove cryptographically that you control those assets, so that you show that you have all the reserves, that you didn't go behind our backs and lend it out to somebody else to make some profit on the side." So it's at least in theory, highly transparent. And then also executing a bank run is a lot easier, because you can wire the money to anywhere in the world. Whereas if you're dealing with the peso in Argentina, you try the bank run. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw physical pesos? And then who's going to want to accept that? What are you going to exchange it for? You know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas if you're in Turkey and you want to do a run on your Bitcoin bank, you can send it. Once it's in your wallet, you send it to a family member who's 5,000 miles away in a flash, right? So you can... There's a lot more vigilance possible from the saving population. I think that is going to diminish the severity of future financial crises. Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. One of the other things I noticed going through some of your old articles is your very early articles on Ethereum. You were saying things that people are starting to say now about it. And I noticed one of your articles, you were short.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously... You were wrong in terms of the financial bet.
Actually, Ethereum went down 70% against Bitcoin after I published that.
Oh, did it really? Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm thinking more long term.
But of course, if you look at the long term, but actually that was a profitable trade for me.
And I was also looking at the dollar value of Ethereum from then. So, because I think the network was, what, $1.5 billion or something then. But do you feel a little bit vindicated now with your...
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, absolutely. Like I'm even seeing a hedge fund who just has this 40-page report about why they're short Ether versus Bitcoin. My best trade of this year was to short Ether versus Bitcoin. Like, so it's something that I've been, I've been trying to separate fundamental analysis from the narrative that's alive in the market, right? And so markets can be wrong for long periods of time. If you look at, for example, Theranos, this huge scandal, huge fraud. It that company was alive for 12 years. Enron was up and running for many years before they went bankrupt and went up in flames. So something I'm trying to be aware of is that like what Keynes says is that you can be the market can be wrong for a lot longer than you can stay solvent, right? But so in terms of indication, I'm just seeing
market can be irrational.
Exactly, irrational. So, my concern was, how is this going to scale? There's probably some other points that you've seen there. It was about, how does this work with multiple implementations? Like, people are saying that it's a positive thing to have all these different clients that supposedly run the same network, but what if they conflict? Also, about the vulnerabilities of these smart contracts I was concerned about. And so all these things we see Ether run into, and still, like, I don't know how long it's been, like 2 or 3 years, there is still absolutely no clear path to scaling for Ether today. And that was my biggest concern, is that, something can work in the short term, but then if you think it through, it's like, how is, like, Yahoo, right? Yahoo was one of those search engines that worked in the short term, but it was all human powered. It was humans that were parsing through the internet and making these portal websites. And of course, that's absolutely not scalable. It was successful for a while, and they got a lot of revenues because all the startups were advertising on Yahoo. But once Google came around and they had an actually scalable solution, they crushed Yahoo. And so that's a metaphor I think works pretty well for me, where Bitcoin was slower, just like Google. Google was search engine number 21 to go live on the internet.
So I agree with a lot of what you say, and I understand it. It takes people, I think it takes other people sometimes to get their heads around this, but do you see any value in any of the work that Ethereum or any of these other protocols have been doing? Anything they've developed? Any other value?
Yeah, I mean, with Ethereum, I struggle because the main premise, in my opinion, was this architectural flaw: the idea that rejecting the notion that if you want to build something complex, you start with something simple and you bolt on another simple thing and another, and then each of those modules has a different function. And that's how you scale, that's how you create complexity that's sustainable and robust. That notion was rejected from early on. Like, Vitalik had a lot of feedback from very smart, very accomplished people that he rejected. And so in a way, because of that, I think people who just had a long-term view and who were had a high pedigree and very accomplished, they just kind of backed off and be like, I'll do my own thing, or I'll focus on Bitcoin or something. Like Andrew Poolstrap, for example, he had a great paper on proof of stake and other altcoin ideas in 2014-15, and that was just ignored. So he was like, all right, I'll just, do my thing and work with people that do agree on this modular idea. And if you look at how the internet is layered, it's just, that there's a stack of protocols. If you look in biology, that's also, it's extremely modular, where everything has its own specific function and everything then works together eventually. So yeah, with Ethereum, I really struggle. If anything, it's showing the market what doesn't work, which, there's some value there. And also there was some signals where there was definitely a demand for securitizing, for startups or organizations to basically sell a part of the ownership in their enterprise in a less bureaucratic way. And then in terms of, other protocols, I think that so fundamentally, modularity is just sound, in my opinion. Proof of work is also sound. I think anything else, pretty much anything else, is voting. Like, you can summarize proof of stake as a voting system. And voting is in essence, a political solution. And I think we've seen over time that, political solutions are not robust over centuries. Like, there's now these theories that under the Sphinx in Egypt, under the pyramids, there were actually there was a library. They were trying to preserve knowledge for the ages, or some kind of secret, or of course it's a burial site, you're trying to preserve that. So if we imagine, like, had the Egyptians built some kind of political hierarchy, it's like, we're going to vote and we'll have these guards, and then, you know, we'll try to get consensus and this and that way. You know, somehow, at some point after 3,000-4,000 years, somewhere in that line, that would have broken down. But what they did instead was they built this giant pile of rocks on top of it, which is proof of work, right? I mean, you need a certain amount of work to remove that, and nobody bothered. And so the secret was actually preserved. It's kind of an illustration, a proof of work. And in biology, you also see all kinds of proofs of that. So yeah, I think when I look at protocols, I want to see that it's built on sound principles. And I also look at the involvement of the engineers. Like, I want to see that there's engineers who have significant achievements in areas that are relevant. So peer-to-peer protocols, it could be the backbone of the internet. I want them to have some serious achievements there. I want them to have achievements maybe in memory compression, because a blockchain is, you know, bloat is almost the biggest enemy of a blockchain. It has to be lean, and that's how it gets decentralized. Maybe also in mathematics or cryptography. I want to see those achievements, and then I'll pay attention. And then I also want to see some Bitcoin developers that somehow have, you know, done some peer review or endorsed, or because really Bitcoin is so difficult. And it's like such a fine line to walk on to try and do this, because you're creating a database that is going to be copied. You're going to store everything forever. That's like crazy. Like, why would you do that? So it's kind of like, but Bitcoin, there's strong enough reason to try that, because you're going to store billions of dollars worth of value. So it does make sense. So those are kind of the things that I look at.
And so do you think governance protocols are kind of overrated?
I think it's almost an oxymoron to me, where it's like, a governance protocol, doesn't that imply some kind of political mechanism to make decisions? Like, I remember having somebody pitch Dash to me for quite a long time, and it was this idea like, oh, we're all going to vote, and it's kind of democratic. And like, I think, first of all, I don't see any large publicly traded companies that have democratic decision making. Like, there's signals from the market, right? The people vote with their money. But when it comes to design decisions, like, you know, Ford didn't ask the market, what should I make? Because they would have told him, make me a better horse carriage. Like, he, you know, did his own thing, and then people voted with their money, and then he built more stuff because he was a visionary.
So do you think governance protocols are ignoring the fact that a lot of advancements in technology and innovation has come from leadership?
Yeah, I think so. And I think so. And also, there's just a certain mindset that is just requires a lot of maturity. I really don't mean like anything like charisma or anything like that. I mean like technological leadership, where you really know the direction to make something sustainable. And so you have this engineering community, this open source community, this whole process that where you iterate very slowly, and kind of like the way Bitcoin Core does it, right? It's a decentralized community, but or Linux. Like, Linux is robust. Imagine if you were to like have public polls on like, what is the next feature we need in Linux? Like, a lot of the value would go lost, because you know that people have no idea what might undermine the fundamental value proposition if they voted on it. So I'm very wary of voting when it comes to protocols. Like, I think, you know, in the long term, you make a product and then the market will decide, do I want it or reject it? But don't let the market literally decide, hold your pen for you, or hold your engineering, you know, your keyboard for you.
It's therefore that I think the point you're making, which I agree with, is in these scenarios, not all votes are equal in terms of where the vote is coming from, not in that there's an equal number of votes. Do you understand what I'm making?
Right.
For example, if we all voted on the next feature for Bitcoin that should be looked at, it could be a very, the development could be very different, because they're people come with different aspects.
It's the average person's time preference is lower than a Bitcoin developer who's been working on it for 15 years and who's invested in it and whatever. Like, they have a longer time horizon. I think maybe a platform like Reddit shows a little bit the weakness of making everything vote based, because the top upvoted posts or comments are not necessarily the ones that will reflect scientific truth. It just, you know, it agrees with whatever the average person agrees with, right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean that Reddit has no value, but, you know, if it was so powerful, we would just see, what's his name again, the new Apple CEO, like, or Jeff Bezos, he would just go to Reddit and be like, all right, Reddit, what should be the next Amazon product? And everybody would vote, and then he would just do that, and it would be best. Like, there's a reason why CEOs don't do that. Because mm-hmm. the market doesn't always know what it wants, or it doesn't always know how to make something sustainable. I don't know.
And I think a lot of people from where I'm from would argue Brexit as the result of a similar problem. False information, wrong information, perhaps something we shouldn't have had a vote on.
Yeah, it gets hard when you start thinking, you know, implementing it or thinking about, like, you know, real life politics, because I think it's a different arena. Because, like, to me, cryptocurrencies and all these things and the internet, there are no barriers, there's no geography, and so just as well as you invite votes from the world, one attacker can pretend to be a million people. Like, you can have Sybil attacks. Like, these are all vulnerabilities to political system. That's why proof of work, I think, is so valuable. It's just like, all right, you want influence? You do the work. Yeah. Like, there's no way to spoof that. Whereas, like, if you do, like, you know, one way that I often explain Bitcoin is like, well, people have this idea that you could, have a decentralized way of making decisions on what is a valid transaction and what is not. So, like, what if everybody with an IP address could vote? But then immediately you run into this problem, like, well, yeah, but you could have botnets that pretend to be 5 million addresses and they have 5 million IP addresses and they attack the network that way. That's, you know, it's a valid attack vector for any kind of proof of stake system. And it's, I don't think you can really, the only way that you can make it a little more robust is to add more work. Like, literally all these penalties that they try and build into is like basically obfuscated proof of work. Right. And it's similar if you, the way they try to prevent political problems is that you build in all these rules to prevent political attacks. Well, in a way, that's also work. Like, you're introducing work into what originally was this pure vote-based system. Like, I think work is just this, you know, meritocracy. It is something that has worked for thousands of years. It's why markets work.
Do you know what? We've come to we've done over an hour. What I would say is my overriding thought from this interview is all roads lead back to Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, I want to be careful to not be dogmatic. Yeah. But I do think that it's important to, like, look at technology and try to take a step back and, like, what are the underlying principles that make something work or valuable? And then, you know, from that framework, look at today and it's like, all right, what makes sense? And so for me, so far, Bitcoin makes sense. I do think there are iterations on proof of work who might be interesting and might be complementary to Bitcoin. There are some privacy innovations that will either be integrated in Bitcoin or be their own protocols. So I want to just be careful. Like, I'm very aware, like, I'm an early Bitcoin adopter. Like, I could have this survivor's bias, right? Where, you know, Bitcoin is great because I know about it and all the new stuff, that's how old people think. Like, yeah. Your brain isn't flexible enough to learn about everything. And so you kind of reject it outright. I just want to be careful to not do that. And, more power to anyone who can, you know, improve upon Bitcoin in any way. I think, you know, the overall thing that I'm excited about is just to have this free market in money. It's just, it amazes me.
Yeah. Well, this has been absolutely great. I would love to do it again in the future. Just before I close out, any final thoughts and how can people find you? And I'll obviously share everything out in the show notes, but let them know.
I just Google my name. I think the top link is my Twitter account, which is Tuur de Meester. And then my Medium account, I think, is number 2.
Okay, well, I'll share it out. But thank you so much, Arthur. It's been great having you on.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that as much as I did? Tuur really was such a nice guy, and it was really interesting to hear him open up about something that was clearly very personal and how it's helped others. So I do encourage you to check the article out. It is in the show notes, but also check out all his other articles. It was also great to listen to him talk about Bitcoin and his thoughts on the scaling issues around Ethereum. I really enjoy his perspective. And please do check out some of the other things he's written, and do obviously follow him on Twitter. I will share out all his links in the show notes. Just a couple of thanks. Just a thank you again to Spencer from Blockchain Capital for letting us use his studio to record this. And also, I just want to say thanks to my engineer, Jason Camiolo. He always gets my shows ready on time, even when I send things over to him at the last minute. If you've got any sound engineering needs, please do check out his website. I'll share his details in the show notes. Please do support the show. If you can leave me a review on iTunes, that would be great. 5-star if you think it deserves it. Please do follow me on social media. My handle is at WhatBitcoinDid on everything, on Steemit, on Instagram, on Medium, on Twitter. Please do check out my website. It is www.whatbitcoindid.com. And please do feel free to email me. I do pretty much reply to anyone, as long as it's not nonsense. So please feel free to email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And please do share out the show with your friends and family. I'm going to be flying back to London on Sunday. I've had a great 3 weeks here in California. I've met some great people. It really, really has been an amazing time. And I'm looking forward to getting back here as soon as possible. And yeah, thanks to everyone who's hosted me. Thanks to everyone who's met up with me. And I hope you all have a great week.